good afternoon. Is this worth more than 300 rand? Do I have to declare it as a present? No? It's not made of gold or something? This? I don't know where it comes from. Okay. I think it looks like a bribe. Okay, it's after lunch. We had four inputs. The first one is agriculture, forestry, and fishery. Do we have the input?
Yeah.
Here we are. Which one? It's a nice thick one. It's called that.
South Africa remains highly vulnerable to food security.
Agriculture is one of the more sensitive sectors of the South African economy, likely to feel any impacts of the climate change, both positive and negative, from the both food security and livelihoods perspectives. Agriculture also contributes less in terms of the GDP, about less than 5% to the GDP, and approximately 13% to the national employment. But its full contribution, if you look in terms of multipliers, for example, the agroecology, it's approximately 12% to the GDP and about 30% to the national employment. agriculture is both an emitter and a reducer of the greenhouse gases. In terms of the country, the national greenhouse gas inventory of 2000, emissions that are coming from agriculture are about 4.6% of the total net emissions. And these emissions are mainly from enteric fermentation and manure management. and 30% of these emissions are from the cropland, 3.7 of the total emissions are from cropland. South Africa is also regarded as a low forest cover country. At least one third of the land area is characterized by some form of forest cover, consisting of natural forest, plantations, and mostly indigenous woodlands and thickets. Plantation forestry occupies about 1% of the land area and contributes about 1.2% of the GDP. Much of the natural forests and woodlands have been degraded and transformed over the past decades, although the exact extent and nature of this loss and degradation is poorly quantified. Natural forest and woodland ecosystems provide vital ecosystem services and forest goods for the benefit of the society as a whole, and in particular to neighboring countries or communities. in the 2000 greenhouse gases inventory, forest lands removed about 80 million tons of CO2, which makes it the single largest sink of greenhouse gases in the country. forests play a pivotal role in livelihoods of the rural poor, and are a vital component of the climate change adaptation at household level. With regards to the fish industry, it is estimated that to have an annual value of approximately 80 billion and employs over 20,000 directly and many more indirectly. Both commercial and small-scale recreational fisheries contribute minimally to the South Africa's GDP, which is about 1.8%. However, aquatic living resources have a high nutritional value, and harvesting thereof contributes to the livelihoods of coastal communities. Well, the main challenge to the fish industry in general is overall decline in catches. This question, the question is, this decline, is it due to overfishing or does climate change play a role? I think this is one of the areas that the department is looking at in terms of conducting an investigation in terms of vulnerability assessment as well. In order to quantify the emissions that are coming from agriculture, as well as identifying the source, the department commissioned a study, or rather the GHG, or Agricultural Greenhouse Gas Inventory of 2004, which looked at some areas where the greenhouse gases are mainly coming from. The main gases that are coming from agriculture are the methanes, nitrogen oxide, the carbon dioxide. So this project looked at areas where these gases are coming, for example, from grasslands, remaining grasslands, and croplands, remaining croplands. Also, the gases that are coming from biomass burning, livestock and manure management. We must be aware that methane is one of the aggressive gases. Also, this looked at the nitrogen oxides that are coming from managed soils, as well as fertilizer applications. The results of this project indicate that the bulk of the emissions, about 44%, they come from dairy cattle. The total emissions, methane emissions, are from the enteric fermentation. If you look at this table, you'll realize that this is a comparison of the greenhouse gas emissions per category in the inventory years from 1990, 2000, and 2004. Since 1990, there have been some increases in some categories and decreases in some other categories. If you look at the enteric fermentation, which is the first one on the table, there's been an increase of gases. But if you look at some other categories, for example, biomass burning, there's been some decreases. This inventory, I think, will assist the department in terms of policy development. We are currently working on developing the mitigation strategy for the sector. In terms of the anticipated impacts and vulnerability from agriculture, climate change will have a variety of impacts. One of the major problems from agriculture in terms of natural disasters is the issue of drought. And because of climate change, we are likely to see a rise in more frequency of droughts, floods, etc. But what happened is that the department also commissioned a study in terms of looking at the mitigation and adaptation options. The output of that study was the Atlas of Climate Change, Atlas of Agricultural Atlas of Agriculture for Climate Change, which highlighted the impacts, which may be not only negative but positive. So evidence suggests that that while some areas will benefit, for example in terms of rainfall, while others will get more drier, others will get wetter. And the whilst the main crop growing areas are likely to remain the same, there are likely to be changes in crops and cultivars. Yields from certain crops will also increase in some areas and decrease in others. Certain previously unsuitable areas for specific crops will become suitable, and vice versa. I'm not going to dwell much on this. Looking at the forestry components, climate change can significantly affect forests through changing their health, physiology, structure, distribution, and species composition. Plantation forestry is a long-term economic investment that is particularly vulnerable to risk associated with droughts, fires, and diseases. There is a significant risk that adaptive capacity of forest ecosystems will be exceeded, compromising their ability to provide vital goods and services and their responsive resilience. Escalation in the number of non-native pests and diseases as well as outbreaks arising from positive and profit will spread much faster intensity. If we look in, at the fisheries, in South Africa, it has already been observed that there have been changes to the characteristics of water bodies, resulting in decreased availability of resources to the fishing community. The pressures of having to extend more effort to catch greater numbers of scarce resources and traveling further distances to fish results in increased fuel usage and emissions from large-scale industrial fisheries, and will in turn contribute to GHG emissions. Implications for the land, inland and freshwater fisheries are similar to that posed to marine fisheries. Literature shows that climate change impacts on inland ecosystems are associated mainly with water quantity and quality. Temperature changes are likely to affect fish species and result in changes in their natural distribution patterns. Variations in the timing of the flooding events may affect fish migration and spawning patterns. In terms of the priorities and policy directives for planning adaptation response, adaptation is a key priority. That is why we think it's important that we develop a climate change adaptation strategy for the sector. But we need to become practical in enhancing adaptive capacity to climate change. In addressing the issue of climate change, it's important that we also address the issue of research and the means of implementation in terms of finance and technologies. Already the department has developed early warning systems that is able to interpret some of the weather forecasting, weather forecasts, and disseminate that information, interpret and disseminate that information to the farming communities. It's important that early warning system as a tool needs to be improved. So that we look in terms of the response capacity as well. The issue of the enhanced risk management is also important that we are looking at. Uh, As I've indicated, that agriculture is also a contributor to contributor of greenhouse gas emissions. Mitigation is one of the.
See, the cows play a big role.
Yes.
Excellent. Change their diet.
Yeah. So we are looking at the issue of mitigation, of course, in terms of that, the improving the diet for livestock and so on. But what we are saying is that adaptation, of course, needs to be elevated in terms of priorities, to be at the level where the mitigation is. And we need to come up with an integrative approach in terms of risk reduction strategies that needs to implement climate change adaptation and mitigation measures and vice versa in order to approach truly an integrative disaster risk reduction. The department is well capacitating the farming community in terms of best farming practices. One of the measures in terms of adaptation and mitigation is diversification, which talks to both crop and livestock. The issue of the drought-resistant crops and flood management strategies. The department, we do have the coping strategy, as you know, that has indicated that drought is a major problem. And we're looking at the issues of crops with shorter germination period and shorter growing season, and also in terms of the selection of varieties that are naturally resistant to specific diseases causing organisms. So these measures will bring some benefits to farmers in terms of improved water management in agriculture, reduced energy consumption for irrigation, reduced CO2 emissions, increased yield and biomass production. Also, in terms of priorities and policy directives for planning adaptation response, some of the measures that are linked, of course, to the conservation agriculture includes zero or minimum tillage farming. This is important, and we're emphasizing the system on conservation agriculture, which requires the minimum soil disturbance. As well as adequate soil cover. And this will bring the benefits to the farmers in terms of increases in growth and development of soil microorganisms, better protection of land against soil erosion, degradation, reduced amount of tractor power, fuel, etc. Also, the livestock management, this is one of the measures that has been looked at in terms of the feeds, formulation of the diet for livestock. There's an initiative in terms of looking into the issue of the new breed for livestock that will be able to adapt to the impacts of climate change. And this, of course, will bring some benefits to the farmers in terms of better animal performance, reduce animal health problems. The programs, adaptation programs that are underway, we do have an awareness program that is an ongoing activity. We do have some structures that are aligned to the department, such as the National Agro-Meteorological Committee. This structure consists of the provinces, the representatives from provinces, Also, it involves the extension farmers who are, in most cases, in touch with the farmers. We also use other programs in terms of engaging the farming community and capacitating them through other programs like the mentorship action programs, as well as the farmers' days. The land care program is another huge program for the department. It talks to the issue of the conservation agriculture. And also some areas that have been identified in terms of adaptation program, because agriculture responded to the call by the National Climate Change Response Strategy in terms of developing sector plans. We already have a climate change sector plan, but it was for agriculture only, because that was done before the merger with the other components. And we think that this will be a baseline in terms of going forward, because the development of the sector mitigation and adaptation plan is a strategic deliverable for the current financial year, so which will be delivered next year. The other important thing is that vulnerability, we have to know in terms of vulnerability, who is vulnerable where. Due to the lack of resources, we had a sort of a pilot project that is able to do some preliminary investigation on vulnerability assessment to climate change in the southwestern part of the Free State province. This is one of the dryland area. Following our mapping exercise, when we did the drought-prone mapping, I've already mentioned the Atlas of Climate Change. This was published. We managed to distribute copies of this document. We have also brought some few CDs for our honourable members. This
beautiful in the pop one. Very nice. Become my favourite department now.
Thank you, honourable chair. Yeah, I think this atlas talks to the. I think investigated the first to the fourth order impacts in terms of rainfall and temperature, looking into the issues of the heat waves, chill units, and so on. And also this will assist us in terms of informing policy development. Also, there are some adaptation and mitigation measures, strategies, that this document has suggested. And we have made this document available to the producers as well. Well, we still think that we need more research to pinpoint the main drivers of climate change. For example, the research on crop suitability. We have planned this sort of a mapping exercise to not only look at the crop suitability, but also look at the vulnerability as well. This is a fairly new project that will take off very soon. In terms of flagship projects, we are part of the technical working group on mitigation. The number of projects that have been listed Some of them are linked to our department, but are led by other departments. For example, on the working for wetlands, where agriculture provides some inputs. But we are planning a project on biomass and biodigester projects, which will not only quantify the emissions but reduce the emissions and talk to the issues of job creation. This will be for the generation of biogas for cooking and lighting from livestock manure. So this is still at initial stage. We have put aside some resources to make sure that this is implemented. But as well, also this will be a pilot project in one of the provinces in the Free State, and it will be rolled out to other provinces. In conclusion, South Africa has insufficient capacity to translate information into knowledge for farmers to respond to climate change challenges and at local level. Uncertainties about the extent of climate change impacts make it even more difficult to quantify the levels of vulnerability of different communities. Broadened knowledge systems need to be integrated with other sciences to maximize the benefits from both systems. We are looking at the indigenous knowledge system also. There is a need to translate what is already known regarding climate change impacts into the knowledge that informs policy making. Awareness of climate change issues by ordinary people could be improved, particularly when we look into the extension services. Climate change and disaster risk management, this must be harmonized with integrative disaster risk reduction. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's quite interesting. It seems that you've proceeded quite a bit as a department down the road of looking at adaptation strategies. It seems that you've gone a bit further than others who are still conceptualizing and putting down a methodology how to do it. So that's interesting. For all the popcorn eaters, any questions to the person who's given you the popcorn? Mr. Morgan?
Thank you very much for the presentation. I mean, indeed, a lot of work has been done. The first question I have is, perhaps this will have to be the result of much further research, but considering the pressures on water already and under the context of climate change, which is likely to result in reduced runoff, at least in certain parts of the country. And considering the possible changes to average temperature in South Africa, which, as we heard earlier, may very well be higher than the global average temperature rise, is the department actually modeling our ability to produce food at various points in the future? We've traditionally been a country that's been able to largely satisfy our own food needs. Because that, I think, really is one of the critical things. Because it would surely also relate to then our ability, or if we were not able to, or if it was diminished, it would then necessitate our need to be able to access and increase the amount of food through the international markets as well, in order to satisfy the calorific requirements for presumably a growing South African population. And hence, Chair, I mean, this is a very critical department when it comes to responding to climate change. So that first part, I mean, are you, you know, modelling those kinds of things? And perhaps this is a bit beyond the scope of your department, but maybe I'd appreciate your comments on it anyway. If there are points in the future where indeed the food security of South Africa is compromised by climate change, are you as a department, or are you at least facilitating any discussions with any other countries in the SADC region who, for example, have higher annual rainfall? There are many other countries in the SADC region which have higher annual rainfall. It's a point, Chair, I remember we made last year in the White Paper about the need for not just a country response to climate change, but at least in some respects, a regional response to climate change, with water being the obvious one. But I would think food security is up there as well, because if we can't...
Fisheries.
If we can't access food just in South Africa, I mean, granted, I know we import and export, you know, various grains and other foodstuffs every year. I'm talking about macro changes here. I mean, to what extent do you as a department also engage with neighboring countries with regards to those that have higher potential to produce grains and the like? That's the first substantial part. I'd appreciate your comments. The second thing, with regards to, if you could just give us some feedback on, with regards to fisheries, specific fish which you have picked up are already being impacted by, say, changes in the ocean. I understand there has been a sort of slight migration in range with some of the rock lobster species already, and of course that affects the, you know, quota holders who tend to be largely attached to a certain geographic space along the coastline. So which are your particular fish stocks which are already showing vulnerability to climate change? Thanks, Jeff.
All these inputs we're getting from fisheries and the coast, yesterday we had input from the coast. Looks like terrible things are happening in the sea at the moment. Anyway, any other comments? Ms. Ringer?
Thank you, Chair. One of the priorities you're talking about is the livestock management and also the benefits to the farmers. I haven't seen any involvement or mention of the Veterinary Institute. Are you working closely together with them when you're considering these options? Thank you.
Any other comments? Have we, you know, your input, where you have a department like yourself now who's clearly looked at some adaptation strategies which are necessary to meet climate change vulnerabilities. It seems to me that if we're going to go in each department, we're going to get a long wish list. Because if you ask a department, what are all the adaptation strategies we need, almost in every area you will try and find, you know, say in fisheries, you know, you'll try and find it in the various areas of that, forestry, agriculture, And so it seems to me that the input we had this morning becomes really vital, Ms. Beaumont, the one of the research selection. Because if that one has the capacity to actually look at these different strategies and to say, this one's important, but it's not going to make a big impact. This one here is going to make a big impact. You know, so that there's some kind of prioritization. Because I can understand, otherwise we can almost have impossible as a government to do all these things, because in all each department we can have a whole string of adaptation strategies. Firstly to fund them, firstly the capacity to run them. And so it seems to me that when a department is a bit more organized and starts doing these things, the next step for us to do is, okay, how do we prioritize? So that we really choose 3, 4, 5 really important adaptation strategies that are going to make an impact in that area, in that sector. And obviously one can still continue with the other adaptation strategies, but clearly, so it just shows you the departments that don't have it, it's difficult for us to engage. And when a department does have the strategies, then it becomes more important how do we prioritize it so we don't have a list of them, which clearly is difficult in some problems. So very fascinating to look at the different levels. And that is why, more importantly, the issue I raised this morning of us sitting down and actually looking at the kind of things you did this morning as well. You know, how do we want each department to proceed with this so that we have, clearly there are going to be differences, but that we have a template of where we're moving. And then this flagship of the prioritization becomes so important. Because first, to cost those strategies, then to see what their outcomes and their impacts are. Therefore, it is important for us to prioritize that one. Now, this one costs a lot. It doesn't make big changes. This one here costs a lot, but it makes big impact. You know? So it becomes very important that we get those things right. And it's very important that we get this technical committee up and running, that we get workshops up and running, that we start talking as a nation on what is adaptation, what is it in each sector, and then how do we work out cost outcomes and therefore prioritize, so that we start working much more systematically. So thanks a lot, it's been quite useful. But now let's have some responses. Of course, any of them can all respond if you want.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Maybe my colleague will come in some of the issues. But if you look on the slide number 5, these are some of the fish stocks that have been affected, specific fish stocks that have been affected by climate change. This includes the demersal, the land fish, rock lobsters, the pelagic, and yeah, these are some of the specific fish stocks. With regards to modeling, we haven't done any work so far, but this is in the pipeline in terms of consulting with the relevant role players. We already have some good relation with some of the stakeholders. For example, we are working well with the South African Weather Service, the Agricultural Research Council, CSIR. So it's something that we are planning to work on. Food security is very, very important. It's a key for us. Also in terms of consulting with other role players, even regional, the SADC regions, there are some forums that we are participating. And in terms of our monthly advisories, we do have an advisory that highlights some areas where food security, the challenges and so on. So there is some consult, communication, engagement with those role players. Okay, the other one was the are we working with closely with the veterinary institute? At the department, we do have the veterinarians. I don't have adequate information with regard to that, but I think maybe my colleagues can come in here.
Any further responses from that delegation? Ma'am?
Hi, good afternoon, Chair and honourable members. I'm from Fisheries. Just to clarify on that point there, the issue with fisheries, as you might have heard yesterday, is that fish live in the ocean. So the fish don't necessarily get directly impacted by climate change. And what we are concerned about more is climate variability. So when you have these storm events or you have increases in temperature or decreases in oxygen, especially on the west coast, which leads to the walkouts of the rock lobster, that's what we look at. So that list there basically just shows that there's been a decline in catches nationally. But the problem with fisheries is trying to identify whether the decline in catches is because of overfishing, fishing pressure, or climate change. And that's what we're looking at. And as my colleague said, that the atlas was done before we joined agriculture, so we used to fall under environmental affairs and tourism. So the guys from the oceans and coast used to take care of the environment in terms of the ocean, and we take care of fisheries management. So now that we have this mandate additional to us, you know, one of the things that DAF is going to have to do is to conduct a vulnerability assessment for the fisheries so that we can be able to really, you know, do further investigation in terms of teasing out what's causing the decline in stocks, whether it's that temporal variability that we see in climate or it's fishing pressure. So, yeah, I hope that clarifies your question.
The picture looks quite bleak, eh?
No, it's quite hopeful. I think South Africa's done
it's
a very good... We've done a good
job
with our fish stocks.
27 species collapsed.
That was a trend, but we've been working quite well and, you know, working towards building stocks is one of our key mandates at the fisheries department. And also, you know, we also have an ecosystem approach to fisheries, which is what was discussed, which was touched on briefly this morning. So even before being drawn into the climate change scenario, we were already looking at a holistic, integrated approach to fisheries management. And with the recent small-scale fisheries policy that just came out last week, we're also looking at the, you know, the role of the, you know, subsistence fisher and how we can help them to become resilient. And, you know, looking also at alternative means in terms of advancing our research with aquaculture as an alternative source of livelihood and also source of nutrition, since food security is one of our main mandates in agriculture and forestry and fisheries. So it looks kind of bleak, but we're working
hard.
We've
got things in place to.
We've got things in place to try and, you know, mitigate for this.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you. Thank you for those answers. I guess I'm reassured that you've got some plans to model food security, and I would certainly urge you to start working on that. The major concern I have is really the regional one, because many of the predicted impacts of climate change are going to hit our neighbouring countries and countries further up in sub-Saharan Africa even worse, and they'll affect South Africa. And if there's anything that's going to drive migration, sort of climate refugees, it's probably going to be the lack of food security, the inability to access food. So, I mean, the likelihood of growing pressures on South Africa from migration, and what it will in turn, the knock-on effects, you know, and food is just but one of those, very important. I see it, Chairperson, as a very important regional cooperative project that actually should be taken. I mean, climate change in this sense is a security threat to South Africa. And I think the Agriculture Department in this regard has a vitally important role to play in helping to not only secure our own security, but to see where the risks and vulnerabilities are elsewhere. And I'll say it's beyond your mandate, but you really have the skills. So I think that is an area, I would hope that is an area that you will increasingly move into and arguably with greater urgency.
Guys, the agriculture thing has to collapse around us. Those people have to go somewhere. We all know where they go. They go south. Want to respond to that? Is there any comment to make?
Thanks, Chair.
Have you been looking at these issues, the regional ones?
Well,
part of climate change?
I think there are programs that are taking place regionally. Not really on issues of climate change, but actually they can have, they can be extrapolated to ensure that, you know, they address issues of climate change. One can talk, for example, on the program of the seed banks that is happening within the region, and the other one involves the conservation of genetic materials coming from the crops of importance. Those are the programs that are taken regionally. And obviously, my colleague has highlighted that there are a number of some of other programs that are taking place. And yes, it might not be that, yes, for now, they are still more precise for climate change, but yes, they can have implications towards that.
Any other else? That's it? Ma'am?
Honourable Chair, just to add to the question on the regional response, yesterday the Department of Science and Technology presented on the Southern African Science Service Centre for Adaptive Land Management, SASCAL. And it's a new program, and it's a program that at this stage involves five countries in our immediate, of our immediate neighbours, Angola, Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, and South Africa are the five, and I think there's intention to expand it. But one of the issues that is coming up in that discussion is the question of food security, land management, water security type issues. So I think that is another example of where there's a kind of a collective thinking around these issues.
All right. Thanks to the part. Look, I think there's clearly you've started doing work, but as you've said already, your work is strongly concentrated on agriculture. You still need to get the other two at the same level. And then, of course, there are all the other areas that we need to look at. As I said, the one of prioritization, cost of these, because those are all important to decide policy-wise, whether that's the way we want to go on. Because, I mean, the cost and the outcome of it will really depend on whether it's a good strategy to pursue or not. So there's a lot of work still to do. As we said before, we will probably meet like this twice a year, where we meet with, try and look holistically at the implementation of the white paper. But I will also engage your chair, Mr. Johnson, to make sure that during the course of the year, climate change stays on that committee's program, so that you guys keep engaging on those issues with the committee as well. So it's not just twice a year, when it's more holistic. So please continue with that work. I've also asked Ms. Beaumont that, having listened to what's going on, I do think there's a need for us sit down with all the departments as government to sit down and look and say, what is adaptation action? Because I'm not too sure, listening to some of the departments, whether what we're hearing is adaptation. It's maybe better government, it's maybe doing things better, but it's not necessarily an adaptation strategy to meet particular issues that climate change may or may not pose as a vulnerability. And so I think all those discussions we have to have a bit more, so that we start developing a South African view of what we think adaptation is. And then, as I say, then the importance become of identifying how much it will cost, what the outcome, what the impact will be, for us then to say, well, we want this one in agriculture, we want this one in fisheries, or want these two in fisheries, this one in agriculture, and we think government should be funding it. In trade industry, we think these two, etc., etc. Clearly, not all of them are going to be successful and get funded. So there's a lot of work still to do, but keep going. And thank you very much for participating and being part of it. Thank you. Okay, Rural Development, Department of Rural Development. Are we here? Are we there, ma'am? Come closer here so I can throw something at you if I don't like what you're saying. Come and sit in the front so you're close by. I want to go like this. Far too far away. Bambili.
My presentation outline will look at you background and the sector climate change response objective. We're talking here of a sector, not necessarily the department, because she wants us to represent the sector in terms of rural development climate change response. That is captured inside the white paper for climate change. Then I would like to talk about the challenges in relation to climate change in the sector, the responses that the department has. So in other words, these are the current projects that we're having that are speaking to climate change adaptation. Then going forward, as you acknowledge, Chair, that we are still a very new department. We have our mandate, we had our mandate in 2009 on the 10th of was it May. Then we have a plan of action which we want the whole sector to buy into. And then we'll then have few recommendations. My background is, and we will talk about the East and where is it from? Where do we derive the mandate of dealing with climate change adaptation sector, climate change adaptation in the sector? The National Climate Change Adaptation Policy Framework requires us to develop the climate change adaptation sector plan, covering livelihood and interventions that support adaptation requirements at household level, specifically on resource-dependent communities such as rural areas. And the plan should focus on unearthing information, trying to get information that is relevant on those vulnerability systems or parameters such as agriculture, water resources, energy, public health, structure of the society and disaster management. Those are the key issues that are associated with rural communities when it relates to climate change. Then the department, just for your noting, that this department is responsible for coordinating outcome 7 in terms of the presidential presidency's monitoring and evaluation framework, which says we are there to create vibrant, equitable, sustainable rural communities and ensuring food security for all. Then in dealing with the plight of poor people, more especially when it comes to climate change, in all spheres of government, even the private sector and civil society, all these structures or all these levels of government must replicate what the National Department of Rural Development is doing or is proposing to do. So as a result, one can then say this department should then be seen as a leader of the whole sector in terms of climate change response programs and projects. Still on my background, in implementing its mandate, the department and all public institutions that participate on Outcome 7 delivery forums always take cognizance of the role of the sector in contributing towards climate change adaptation. And several projects and programs were deliberately established within the department. We're still going to establish what other sector departments and municipalities have done, so that we streamline what we're doing with the whole sector. But at present, we have established a unit, Technology Research and Development, whose main mandate is to research on alternative technologies in implementing our projects, instead of relying on conventional methods of implementing projects. And we also have established something which is not on part of this. I think I've given a wrong presentation, but it was only this thing. We have established a unit, Rural Disaster Mitigation Services, where we ensure that all our rural communities that are being affected by severe natural disasters, it be drought, it be flood or whatever, then we're able to rush into those areas and assist. We also have established a unit, Environmental Planning Support, and the unit dealing with compliance, environmental compliance of the department. And this presentation later on will be talking about how the sector should deal with issues of forging consensus in terms of the plan of action of the whole sector and outline the key components of the climate change adaptation plan. I think Ms. Beaumont will not get tired in guiding us on that one. The next slide, Chair, speaks to challenges that the rural settlement sector, as defined by the climate change policy, is facing. The rural communities are the worst hit with regard to the impact of climate change, because it affects their livelihood in that systems such as agriculture, water resources, energy, public health. You will recall scientists talk about malaria now encroaching in areas such as Gauteng because of changes of temperature, social and natural systems. So we are actually concerned with those. That is what maybe the plan should look at, ways of solving those problems. We also have learned, like you highlighted, Chair, we are quite a very new department, and as a result, we need to have a scan of our policies and legislation to see where do we need to align, where can we come with interventions to align policies with climate change responses or climate change interventions. We also have inadequate integrated planning and decision making that usually negates the considerations of climate change. Technology research and development and innovation basically still need to be strengthened. Yes, we acknowledge we have the unit dealing with that, but how do we get it down into local municipalities, into provinces, and other players in the civil society? We also have a challenge with regard to resource allocation and mobilization. We need to re-engineer and streamline those interventions. When I listen to role players, when they talk about resource allocation and mobilization, usually they refer to mitigation measures, but very little we have on the adaptation sector. We have also noted, though we believe that the plan will be able to resolve that problem, lack of intergovernmental coordination within the whole sector. We need to work on that, Chair. How does this department then respond to this issue? We have got several projects that this department is implementing that speak directly to issues of climate change. The Chief Directorate Technology Research and Development has been doing the project called Conservation Agriculture. That is where we have assisted about 44 communities in Mkhonsho, in the Eastern Cape, and Msinga in KZN. What do we do with this project? We have realized in the Eastern Cape and Singa in KZN. And with this project, what we aim to achieve is we do not, because the problem with what causes degradation and maybe desertification is our unwise plowing methods. So this time around, this technology doesn't involve the tilling of land. So we just go and dig a small hole there and plant. Then we'll find another, some organic ways of dealing with wheat without necessarily using inorganic pesticides or, I mean, herbicides. So this then will help our communities fight issues such as degradation, desertification, food insecurity, and loss of biodiversity in general. So I have the breakdown of the number of the wards that we have assisted, number of households, women and children and youth that we have assisted. This unit also have lots of projects around indigenous knowledge systems, where a lot of campaigns in the Pompo, Northwest, and KZN were conducted, educating people of the values of preserving, protecting, and commercializing the benefits of IKS. So this assists communities to always consider indigenous knowledge system to methods to adapt to climate change variability. So the picture there is a no-till planter where the grass has first been destroyed by a grass cutter. Then we dig a hole with this and we plant instead of plowing the land, which will then result in erosion and other forms of land degradation. The picture below is actually a combination of new technologies or new thinking in agriculture and indigenous knowledge systems, where communities are taught what we call multiple cropping. You find in communities that are now experiencing very high temperatures because of climate change, then we teach them the technique of plowing between tall crops so that it provides shade to this shorter bushes. Like you see here, butternut growing just under the leaves. I mean the mealies. Then technology research and development have conducted research in 8 provinces with regard to indigenous knowledge systems that exist. And now they've compiled a report in terms of what exists and what can be used. As we're speaking, our sister branch, TRIF, the branch responsible for social facilitation, is busy implementing some of this by enterprising our communities with regard to using their indigenous knowledge in creating livelihoods. Oops. I skipped this one. Okay. Chair, we also having another technology that is aimed at assisting our communities that are hit hard by such things as floods. Sometimes last year we have seen almost a third of the country being hit by floods. So in the process we piloted with 13 houses of a building technology using sandbags. We feel permit, and you will see the picture on my next slide. So they are very cost effective because we just use sand from rivers, which is available, and that technology then can contribute to both mitigation and adaptation measures, because we are not going to use cement that in the process will emit a lot of carbon gases in manufacturing it. We just use the only cement, I mean the only greenhouse gases that will be emitted is through the production of those sacks of bags. So that is a very good technology in contributing towards climate change purposes. So scientists note that the emission of a 1 square meter of a sandbag wall will drop by more than 95% as compared to the conventional brick wall. Because in a conventional brick wall, then you'll have to bend bricks, or you rely on cement, which at the source then demands a lot of energy. If natural material such as hemp, chairperson, was to be used, would then cut by more than 95%. But we're still having a small project within technology research and development to look at the durability of an organic material such as hemp in a building like that. Will it degrade in value? Instead, we might, in the process, still rely on our geotextile and geotextile bags. This technology is user-friendly, as I indicated. It actually promotes water efficiency, energy efficiency, and exhibits thermal stability. And the houses are warm. Then we end up having houses which don't need to be heated. And it is appropriate in areas that are vulnerable to flood. You'll understand it's sand inside. When there is a water lock, sand doesn't actually dissolve in water. Instead, it will just allow water to pass. So when water is at this level, by the time water is no longer in the area, then you have your house, because the sandbags were allowing water to flow through. So here is one of those houses. Unfortunately, we didn't give you the opportunity to see a complete house, but those who are interested, we can show them offline. That under rural disaster mitigation, we had three main projects since last year. We trained communities at a value of 850,000 from 9 rural communities on disaster risk reduction and community range. Disaster risk management. Then we also have social relief projects, which we have done in 808 households at a value of 27 million. That was last year on the on the disaster that I was referring to. And we have also established disaster management help desks in what government calls Tusong centers. That benefited about 41 local municipalities in total. That said, these are some of the communities that benefited from particular type of training. In the main, it was like your fire prevention and fire extinguishing techniques. Then what we were giving to communities as a relief, as a social relief after those natural disasters, we provided shelter, gel stoves, oil lamps, solar lights, radios, which are powered by solar, and lightning conductors. The next slide, members would ask themselves, infrastructure projects, how do you assist in climate change, because infrastructure usually destroys. But we have got those vulnerable communities such as rural communities. Because they are very dry, very hot, their investment, seldom go there. So what government needs to do is to ensure that we develop infrastructure. The question is, what kind of infrastructure do you introduce in those communities? So the climate change impact may affect communities in key facets of life, hence the sector implement infrastructure projects. Like I said, we're saying it's infrastructure, we're saying the sector implements this project. You will recall with our comprehensive rural development program, we are not going there as a sole department. We go there and establish a council of stakeholders where all departments, any other person, including the community structures, we sit down and come up with ways of dealing with poverty, ways of dealing with all this infrastructure backlog. So in trying to meet basic needs in Mieje village, just to give an example, we have done 330 houses, a borehole, we equipped a borehole, water purification and so on, with the help of DBSA, and we ensure that they get water through recirculation system projects. Then we refurbish clinic. You will understand malaria in those areas is quite a problem. So we assist them. We build a clinic to ensure that they have primary health care available closer to their doorsteps. Then we also have some social infrastructure projects such as your clinic, your post offices, satellite police station, etc. Then we also involved in education projects where we build schools or renovate them, and we use ICT services to access our rural communities. We also have economic development projects where in your EPWP kind of model, we implement projects where we build gabions on degraded land and we do fencing. This Mieje community is very close to the Kruger National Park. So we tend to forge a relationship between the Kruger National Park and the Mieje community. So we also have fenced arable land for communities to do their farming there, and we did about 300 household gardens, and just to ensure food security, Chairperson. We have done this in Limpopo. These are just selected. You will understand the CRDP has been all over the country. We have done this in Gongongo, Dingamazi, giving them solar-powered street lights, and so many. We have done some work in Masia, Sikukune. At Sikukune, Chair, we have done a comprehensive sustainable rural settlement planning for them, so that by the time any person thinks of going there to implement any project, you will remember Sikukune is part of the 23 district municipalities that the minister wants government to focus on. So they will use that particular plan to implement instead of doing things that are not sustainable in the long run. In Limpopo, the plan is for the rest of Kukune, most especially in Jenfes. Then that is where we concentrate in terms of this development. Then. You see the pictures there of a solar plant in Diatalawa in the Free State. We intending to change Free State into an eco town. That will, it's a green village that will actually embrace any new technologies in terms of I mean alternative technologies in terms of fighting climate change. You will see the solar panel there, the school there has been, that we have built for them using solar energy. So this slide summarizes some of the technologies that I've been talking about in the previous slide, Jefferson. So the next slide will be highlighting our plan of action. What are we intending to do? The National Climate Change Adaptation Policy Framework requires this department to develop the Climate Change Adaptation Sector Plan. And this requirement has also been elevated to Outcome 10 Delivery Agreement, where the President wants this department to produce, in consultation with the rest of the sector, this sector plan. We call it sector plan because we believe the strategy is what Ms. Beaumont is responsible for at national level, but we are responsible for a plan. But we have now concluded our terms of reference on this in less than a month would have started. So we are still, the terms of reference now are still going through internal processes. Judy, these terms of reference, please allow us to put them on your desk so that you make input on, so that whatever we do is in line with the national directives. So the plan will focus on identifying areas that require policy review for the whole sector. We'll look at the role and the institutional arrangements of all stakeholders within the sector, coordination and communication mechanism, and we need to identify constraints and opportunities for job creation, because you can't talk green economy without actually talking about job creation. So we want to look at job creation within this green economy regime, especially as it relates to your national intervention programs, such as the National Rural Youth Services Co-ops, your Comprehensive Rural Development, your EPWP. We need to look at those. Chef, the plan will also outline the model that the sector should use for resource allocation and mobilization. That is the key. And how then do we use those funds, especially when we look at funding initiatives, capacity building, education and awareness, science and technology. We need to outline that. And we also expect this plan to come up with a monitoring and evaluation framework, which will talk to the broader presidential performance and monitoring evaluation framework, especially when it refers to outcome 2, 4, 7, 8, 9, and 10. These are mainly related performance outcomes which speak to issues of climate change. And as we are reporting on quarterly basis on this, then the department will be able to assist in mapping the way forward. But it is expected that the following issues will be addressed by the plan. I won't take a lot of time on this. So we want to define the scope and design the scope for adaptation, rural sector adaptation sector plan, design the mechanism for engaging all stakeholders, assess vulnerability of communities to direct climate change adaptation attempts, and we assess the current and the future climate risk, particular emphasis should be given to the first, second, and third order drivers with the 2050 projections as defined by the National Climate Change Adaptation Framework. And we need to assess current and changing socio-economic conditions of the rural settlement, assess and enhance adaptive capacity of rural settlement, especially in the context of existing IKS and modern technologies. We need to then formulate the plan for the department, but we need Chairperson in the process to identify the flagship project, preferably in two CRDP projects, where we'll be able to come to Parliament next time and say, as the department and the sector in general, this is what we think should be the model for adaptation plan. So we also intend to, or we are already through sustainable land use management. Chair, you will recall it might have crossed your desk one day, the Special Planning and Land Use Management Bill that is going through the NCOP process. SPLAM. Yes. So it's the fanciest bill in Parliament. Thanks for that. Yeah, so you look at its development principles, Chair, then you will realize that from legislative point of view, we do not negate issues relating to sustainable development and climate change in particular, because we realize that it is very important for us to embrace the importance of environmental management in the bill. So one of the key tools that SPLAM proposes is the Spatial Development Framework. I think Honorable Member Morgan will be happy to hear what I'm going to say now, that we in terms of Outcome 10 Delivery Agreement, government in general has agreed that there is no Spatial Development Framework that will be called credible if it is not informed by a recognized, or let me say, by an adopted environmental instrument such as EMF. So what SPLAM then proposes is that we will have the national, regional, and local FDF. At your national level, what DD Jim Keten was saying here, that they are going to do the mapping of the whole country, then that mapping then will then inform the National Spatial Development Framework. Then at provincial level, you will have your bioregional plans and conservation plans inform the provincial spatial development frameworks, and your EMF stroke strategic environmental assessment will then assist in informing the spatial development frameworks of local municipalities and districts. So it is something that sub-output 3.5.1 of the delivery agreement is advocating. So as a department, we have got few projects already that of assisting municipalities in developing SDFs that talk directly, that goes directly to municipalities that the Department of Environmental Affairs has already developed the EMF. And where they are intending to develop EMFs, then will come later with this SDF project. Like now, the Frederford Dome, they are doing an EMF for the Frederford Dome. We have already committed during our bilateral meetings and in the form of your steering committees for that project, that we're going to do a regional spatial development framework that will talk to that particular project. So even the land use management schemes have to talk to the issues of environment. So SPLAM is very clear on how environmental issues need to be engaged. But just for your noting, Chair, that the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change has got an ad hoc committee on land use change, and forestry, LULUCF. That one, we then find ourselves being a mitigation sector as well, because with spatial planning and land use management, then we can assist in keeping greenhouse gas emissions through proper planning. Chair, as I'm about to conclude, the department has also established a unit dealing with environmental compliance. The main reason is that the National Environment Management Act lists this department under Schedule 1 and 2 as the department that affects the environment and also assists in environmental management. So because of that, Chapter 3 requires us to compile a consolidated environmental implementation and management plan that will outline how are we going to deal with emerging environmental issues, including climate change, as well as how are we going to contribute towards environmental management portfolio of the whole country. So our CIMP, or the Consolidated Environmental Implementation Plan, has been gazetted last year in March, and we are reporting on annual basis on that. And it proposes that the department must then compile a policy and a guidelines for integrating environmental planning in our rural development and land reform projects. So the project is underway, and we are going to conclude that project by end of July this year. So that is the project that will guide our officials in terms of ensuring that all environmental dynamics of the project are outlined. It will be a web-based tool that will assist a plan aligning in our offices in Limpopo. How do you determine if this project needs an EIA? How can you link this to climate change adaptation issues? So it's what we're aiming to achieve with that project. And the department also have a forum, Environmental Compliance and Implementation Forum, that takes all departmental units together for the sake of coordination, information sharing, and consultation on all environmental issues, so that we're not seen to be working in silos. So we are recommending, Chair, that the portfolio committees sitting here today just note the emerging issues and challenges of the rural settlement sector. And maybe, please, if you can provide guidance, as we are still a new child in the block, just for us to know if we are in the right track. The issue of approaching it as a sector is the right thing, if all those political directives we require from you for us to start on the right foot. Thank you, Chair.
No, look, I appreciate that, what you've gone through. As you've indicated, a lot of these structures, yours is new. But I've also noted that you've reached the stage where you have the terms of reference for your plan and so on, and that you will be consulting further with Ms. Beaumont about that. I've also asked her to pull together all the departments so we can start talking through this concept of adaptation. What does it actually mean? You know, and then how do you apply it in each of the sectors, and then how one will then prioritize and look at the outcomes. Because there may be hundreds of adaptation strategies in your sector, but maybe four or five of them can be funded and will be have a good impact. Maybe the others will have a smaller impact, etc. So those discussions he will be engaging further with you, so that by the end of the year when you guys come, hopefully we'll start seeing more unified, more united progress in most of the departments on adaptation. So thanks a lot. But comments, Mr. Morgan?
Thanks very much for the presentation. Well, you invited comments, as you said, called it political direction. I mean, I'm clearly probably in the wrong party to give you political direction, but I'm going to give it anyway. The problem I have with what is being presented is that it's a little bit ad hoc, quite frankly. It's not rural development. The Rural Development Department, by its very nature, overlaps with so many other entities, spheres of government, and many of the things that you do can conceivably be done by other spheres of government, quite frankly, and are being done by other spheres of government. And so in some sense, I sometimes think that you kind of have to justify your existence as a rural development by department by looking busy. And so I'm not convinced about your role in these kind of ad hoc projects. I get the point about spatial planning and land use. That is of absolute importance, and thank you for highlighting it. It was exactly the point I was making during Mr. Mkhitani's address. And I know that a lot of work has to be done on that bill and the provisions in the bill, and that will be done in due course by our colleagues in Parliament. But that is the right contribution. I guess what I'm going to say is that, I mean, the rules of you've got a role. I think other departments and spheres of government can probably do much of what you're trying to do better and more coordinated. My personal view is where you can make the greatest contribution to adaptation to climate change is, of course, in the core business of the other part of the department, which is land reform. I mean, you focus a lot on the rural development side, but it's in land reform where we can really make changes to improving human dignity and giving people, say, productive access to land through title and all the various other things. I mean, rural dwellers, as has been said before, are going to be affected disproportionately by the impacts of climate change. And therefore, one of the best ways we can deal with it is to give people increasing ownership or forms of greater title so that they can be productive and they can raise bonds and they can raise money against their land for, you know, for different farming methods. In a sense, it's probably the best way of keeping people in rural areas. So, I mean, if I was you, I would say your biggest contribution to adaptation is a lot of the core work on the other side, in actual land reform. And I know that there are challenges there. I know the Treasury, you know, never gives enough money for these things. But that's critical to me. That is the way to really empower rural South Africans. And I'm not trying to delve in the controversies of it. I know that there are many different formulations and different people from different ideological persuasions have different approaches to that. I'm talking about the general concept, which I think we all agree upon, and that is the human dignity side and the empowerment side of land. So that would be my chairperson political direction for what it is worth. And I say it genuinely, because I wouldn't want you to dabble in things which are just are repetitions of other departments. And it's very difficult to see, you know, why you work here and why you don't work elsewhere. I mean, most national departments have a kind of global view that where their actions can potentially touch a mass amount of people across South Africa. At the moment, and maybe it's a capacity issue, your actual on-the-ground actions, as important as they are to the people who they are touching, are very, very limited. Thanks, Chair.
Ms. Dr. Huang?
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, thank you for your presentation. I think regarding for your technology research and the development for that is the center house. I just like to know, you send back for the building of the center house resource technology. Then where you get the sand? You get it from the river bank. If you get it from the river bank, how many tons of for you get it from the every day? And I think what's this impact for the river, on the river? This also could add a bigger issue, because what is cost to the ecosystem in the long term? Because if you are saying it's a technology by the same bank for the building the house, this one, the first time I hear this one called technology. But you already influence for the ecosystem. How is the river bank in the future? And also, I think you highlight for job creating regarding the infrastructure. You say the job created 319 jobs is for the reason, I think, economic development by that is 17 kilometers. For fencing, the 300 house garden is fenced. And the other you highlighted for the 34 communities is a beneficial, is created about for 142 job creation. Chairperson, I think it's a this is a public hearing from the every different diversity department coming for the briefing. I'd like to know what you respond to the climate change in the white paper, of special from your rural development, because you highlight for infrastructure, job creation. Morning we have the other biodiversity and conservation. They also highlight for some projects, including the EPWP. I'm only asking questions because the 7 projects already involved EPWP. So get from EPWP, this fund is about for 24 million to the 30 million. So from your rural development, this project always is participated by the community. So I'd like to know from EPWP side, how you coordinate and also how many funding projects you are the coordinator with link with the EPWP, because it is quite important for the, we're talking for job creation. Thank you.
Mr. Matebe.
Thanks, sir. I align myself with Mr. Moyo. I'm not really convinced as to whether what you are doing is really your core business. For instance, you're talking of this sandbag houses. It looks like a good project because you are not using cement and water, which is a part of adaptation measures. But again, where you get this cement, I mean this sand, are you then not contributing towards the effects of soil erosion, which will impact on climate change? And also the other issue would be, wouldn't it be wise to have an integrated sort of development rather than doing all these things as rural development, rather than engaging other departments like human settlement and see as to whether this will not take us somewhere? And also again, the other problem that I would have is are these houses not going to be plastered? So if they are not going to be plastered, where is the decency? Because the issue is not just to have a house, but people should have something that they can really call a house. Something that is decent. So just having some bags on top of another one and then definitely we're dehumanizing our people. So can you just like,
In your responses, can you explain this thing to me about the department's mandate and being responsible for the sector? I mean, when I hear you talk, I'm hearing you saying to me, I'm reporting here on sectoral things, which may not be the department's mandate, because otherwise you shouldn't have to make that statement. So I think you should explain that better, because that may also help some of the questions that were asked. Because you may be reporting on things here which your department is not necessarily doing, but the sector which you're part of and you're reporting and being part of the adaptation committee is doing it. But then you must delineate that to us clearly so that we can understand where your department's work starts and where it's actually sectoral work and it's other departments. Okay? So just in your answer, just make sure you make that distinction.
Thank you.
I think those are all the questions.
Thank you, Honorable. Very little, Honorable Chair. Yeah, no, thank you, Chair. I'll try as much as I can to try and explain our role and mandate as this new department. Because now we sat down, we had long hours trying to unpack, trying to understand what our new mandate was, because previously we were just the Department of Land Affairs. Now, with this new mandate of land reform, being guided by our new minister, Minister Quinton, we saw that now we're working on the rural space. And working there, we started by saying that our mission there is to do many, many things because it's cross-cutting. And it is true, in terms of the observation of the honorable members, that we do almost everything and anything. The program that we came up with was the Comprehensive Rural Development Program. In other words, we try to do whatever we can do in the rural space comprehensively. Because we find that rural communities are very, very vulnerable in terms of all sorts of what you can get in terms of the fact that the basic needs are almost not there. You find that they are the most vulnerable to disasters, to issues relating to climate change, that we cannot do one without the other. We try by all means, when we work within that rural space, to coordinate, to facilitate, and to initiate some of the projects. In other words, it is our role then to invite other partners, like other sister departments, who, as the honorable members have stated, maybe more relevant in terms of resolving some of those issues. But however, since we are there, we have found that even within those other sister departments, capacity is not really there. And we have found that really rural communities have been marginalized for quite some time, maybe because of lack of resources and other things. So then we tend to not to turn a blind eye to what we see in the rural space as we go there, as we work there. In fact, as we were working in some of these communities, then there were worse disasters that hit those communities. I think it was beginning of 2010, with lightning, with thunder, with floods, so that we had to bring in some disaster solutions into the area. Yes, some people have said we have the Department of COCTA, who are better placed to do those disaster things, but they have not been there. So we've worked with them. We are teaming up with them. We attend fora with them, and they understand now. They say, actually, according to them, every sector department has to contribute in terms of what they can do when disaster hits. So they understand very well. We report to those fora what it is that we're doing there. And in terms of what was presented here, we then try by all means to do what we will try to be what green to bring things that will not cause any more emissions or people that are not be exposed to fires necessarily, like the oil stoves that we give them, the solar solar light, and also so that they are not so vulnerable to lightning, and give them lightning conductors, all those things that we do to assist them, and also to train them. Coming then to issues of land reform, we try also to train them in terms of mitigating against fires. Those were the training that we gave to them. And we have also, I think it was also came into the presentation, that we are developing policies and guidelines to try and mitigate against those disasters, so that we make sure that the environmental planning that we do assist them to provide those guidelines in terms of their projects that they do in land reform and also to rural development sector. So yes, we almost do everything and try and coordinate, but we do liaise with other departments in the work that we do in the rural space, which is part of rural development.
Thank you. Just to add on what DDG Mahalmele has said, just maybe a direct response to what Honorable Chairperson has requested me to do, this role of coordinating the sector. I was fortunate to be included on the team that drafted the white paper on climate change in terms of your PSC meeting. Inside the climate change response framework, rural development was a sector just like that. But going forward, as we discussed the content of the white paper by then, now a policy, we agreed that rural development is a cross-cutting issue. As a result, we rather look at it as a rural settlement. If you open the climate change policy today, it will talk to rural settlement. Mainly because each and every department which contributes to livelihood, it be water, it be housing, it be transportation, contribute in one way or the other towards climate change mitigation, I mean, and adaptation. Then, who then will then rise and say, I am responsible for coordinating all these government efforts towards climate change adaptation and mitigation? Then that is where the climate change policy outlines to say when in other, like your outcome 10 delivery agreement, the department has been tasked with the responsibility to do that. So I will say, Honorable Member Morgan, you see, issues of mandates are political in nature. And all our thought by my DG is that, look, ANC had five priority issues on its manifesto. One of them was rural development and land reform, right? And the ANC then said, we now have to broaden our mandate to include rural development. So this is the route we have to follow. So teaching me about the minister's comprehensive rural development program, they said to us, the comprehensive rural development program stands on three feet. That is agrarian transformation, rural development, and land reform. And these three are interlinked. Where we had rural development, I mean, where we had land reform projects, in trying to make sure that land reform project is beneficial to the community, then we implement the comprehensive rural development program in those particular areas. So it's not like there is a unit dealing with land reform in silos without necessarily implementing rural development projects in those areas. So we actually interlink. So it is the reason why we have to coordinate the whole sector. Because going down to provinces and municipalities, the efforts that are made in the rural space are not coordinated and they cannot be properly reported. So if through your outcome 7 delivery forum, we can then come up with a mechanism, which I know is there, to report on our efforts. If you look at the outcome 10 delivery agreement, I've gone through some of these agreements. Outcome 7 delivery agreement is the one that has so many participants than any other delivery agreement, simply because rural development is a cross-cutting issue. DAF, with all its four components, is there. Are they three? Then environmental affairs, everyone actually is there, except your your support services such as your administration, Department of Public Administration, but the rest of your line function departments are part of Outcome 7. The issues of riverbanks being maybe vulnerable to degradation as well. You'll note that South Africa's position in terms of climate change. As it is captured by the white paper and any other document, including the South African position towards COP17, we're saying, as a country, we have to first look at our developmental imperatives before we think about damaging the environment. Then later we come up with a technology that will least affect the environment. So, if you will note my illustration that you use sandbag technology, you're reducing up to 95% of greenhouse emissions. Definitely, if you were to do trade-offs, sand is created as the river flows every day through your collision of rocks inside water. Then you have sand. And we will always use natural resources to build our houses. So in terms of trade-offs, definitely harvesting sand from a river will be better than emitting greenhouse gases. So that is the trade-offs we're trying to make. But however, you recall, we said we've got technology research and development. Their role to research, pilot. I said we piloted in 13, we have 13 sandbags, houses. Then now, what follows is to look at whether, I mean, those houses really serve the people. That over here, then we're going to determine whether that technology works. What are the shortcomings? Can we roll it out through, countrywide? So I would believe that the unit which Mr. Mashaban is coming from will continue to do research to see if what they've developed will work going forward. Then what kind of material do we leave those sacks naked as they look? I'm sorry, we could not put the complete out. We use some sort of a porous material that will allow water to penetrate in case there is this lot of water flowing. Say it's flat and there is this 1 meter level of water. Then it will allow, people will then be evacuated and water will just flow through the walls of the house. Instead of bulldozing the house, then water will flow freely into the house. And by the time floods are, then that comes with natural disasters. Yes, the house will be standing. So, remember, we still have pilot phase. We are developing this technology. How it works, then is the next step. So, Chairperson, thanks. I don't know if.
But bag houses. But we've run out of time. We still have 2 inputs. It's 4:15, so we better wrap up. But thank you very much. It's interesting things you do. Obviously, there'll always be a level at which you can have original powers and a level where you coordinate, and I'm sure when you get become an older department, you'll start distinguishing those things better, so that you don't overlap with other departments. But the work you're doing, please keep on with it. We'll follow it as we go along, and we appreciate your presence and your input. Thank you. Human settlement. There is tea outside again, but we're not going to adjourn. We're running late. Can we have human settlements moving closer? Actually, a very clever concept. Very clever. Think about it. You don't create any carbon in making the house. And if it's in the rural areas, particularly rivers and so on, it's something can stand. You're very clever. You just take the things, you put them on the river bank so that the river doesn't overflow, and then you go put them back again in your house later. Human settlements? Are you there, ma'am? Good. When you're ready, you can start. Which input is it here? It's this one that's colorful. Orange and so on.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, Honorable Members. My name is Namso Maliso. I'm representing the Department of National of Human Settlements. I've been asked to make the presentation this afternoon. By way of outline, by way of outline of our presentation, we'll start about our legislation and policies that compel us. Did I move it again? Okay. to start from there where we get our direction from in terms of legislation and policy. We also want to touch on our challenges that as we experience in respect of human settlements. I will touch on the actual house structure and in terms of the settlement at large and what current strategies we have to address those challenges and other proposed programs and initiatives that we have in place as a department. Alright, in terms of the Constitution, Section 21 says that everyone has the right to have access to adequate housing. My apologies, I'm supposed to say access to adequate housing. And adequate housing is defined not only just as a roof or a shelter over one's head, but it also includes a couple of points, and I think relevant to this afternoon's discussion, to mention that it should be a suitable environment and suitable environmental quality and health-related factors, and that there should be adequate and accessible location with regard to work and basic services. So we need to maintain that balance, which we haven't in most instances. The next slide talks to... primary legislation, the Housing Act, which talks about municipalities that I must ensure. Okay, thank you. Or I can. My apologies. Can you use that? The mic. Okay. So we go. Oh, I can. That's better. Thank you. Our primary legislation, the Housing Act, it compels that in their planning, municipalities must also ensure that inhabitants have access to adequate housing and that if there are any conditions that are not conducive to health and safety of the inhabitants, that those must be removed or prevented. We also have the comprehensive plan for the development of sustainable human settlements, which was approved in 2004. This uses housing delivery as an instrument for development of sustainable human settlements, and it sees... and it places emphasis on the quality of the housing product, not only on the housing product, but also... on the environment as well. So it compels us from 2004 to make sure we not only provide a house, but we make sure that we produce quality living environments. Challenges that we have in respect of our human settlements, we have settlements that are usually smoggy. This would refer to your informal settlements as you find them. They are barren wastelands, and in some instances you may find our informal settlements are located in ecologically viable areas, and they destroy some important fauna and flora. Also, our settlements are sprawling. We have settlements that are outside of city centers, so it means that people take time, and there's a long distances to travel to work. There's emissions from the cars and buses that people take to work, not only also forgetting that when people travel those long distances, they have to wake up earlier, they give up time as well. It costs also in time aspects as well. Our informal settlements, usually on invaded lands, there will be no services in those instances, and so people place pressures on the environment in terms of polluting the environment in them as well. In terms of the actual house themselves, households, they utilize non-renewable energies, coal and paraffin, to heat up and warm up their houses, emitting toxic fumes, meaning that there will be poor indoor air quality for those houses, and people will get sick as a result. The houses are cold in winter, they're hot in summer, so people need significant energy consumption to cook and to also heat. Using coal at that stage, which may be harmful to their health, and also in terms of electricity that is not sustainable, we've seen increased instances of load shedding and blackouts in most areas. Our current strategies, how we try and address these issues. We have the national norms and standards in respect of housing development. These are standards that are set to make sure that whatever we provide in terms of human settlement and housing, we adhere to those. We don't make we adhere to those so that we have quality houses and we also have quality living and environments. The standards were usually concentrated on just the house only. These were enhanced to include guidelines on environmentally sound housing. These concentrate on issues of passive design. We recommend that when we're at the design stage, municipalities should design the orientation of houses should be in the northern hemisphere so as to obtain maximum sunlight, so that people do not have the houses in summer are cool enough and in winter they are warm enough and they may not require excessive heating. Also in terms of the house and the plan of the house and the layout, we recommend that the windows and the doors should be on the northern side and should also be roof overhangs also on the northern side. These currently are on our policies on the housing code and they require little or no cost implications. One of the major factors are prohibiting us from developing further standards and so forth would be the cost issues. Also in terms of design, we recommend that the design units that share walls, as these units they provide insulation against heat loss and undesirable heat gain. Also in terms of energy efficient materials, if there are any materials that are able to retain heat during the day and release it at night, we also recommend the use of those as long as they are approved by the certifying bodies like Agrimine South Africa and the National Home Builders Regulatory Council. Also in terms of insulation, to keep the house cool and on a hot day and warm on some cold nights, and that our windows may be larger to allow maximum sunlight. And we also have strategy on greening where we recommend that even inside the houses as well, people be encouraged to have their own gardens, not only is it for their own sustenance, but also on their pavements to have grasses and also in their neighborhoods to also have trees and parks. Also in terms of water efficient design considerations, we recommend the use of correct pipe sizing and correct water pressures so that we don't have water gushing and there's waste of water into the houses. As also as water saving devices, pressure reducing valves so that they can control the flow of water into the taps and toilets and buildings. In terms of policies and housing programs that we have to address also some of the issues, we have the informal settlement upgrading program that has been there for a while, but in terms of the outcomes-based delivery, outcome 8, which talks to human settlement, we have been mandated to make sure that by 2014 we have at least provided 400,000 households with access to tenure and services. In this regard, the department has established a support program to the 49 municipalities that were identified that have fast-growing informal settlements. The department is assisting those municipalities in terms of prioritizing informal settlements that they can upgrade, and we have in partnerships with the World Bank that are assisting with the rollout of that program. We also have the program for the provision of social and economic amenities. This is in recognition that most townships, even from the before 1994, do not have social and economic amenities. They don't have parks and so forth. So this is a grant that can be applied by a municipality that can be available to provide these amenities. It's also applicable to new developments as well. There's also the Integrated Residential Development Program, which is a flagship program for the department, which we try and provide housing developments with. So where you have a mixed use of uses in one development, this is where we have partnerships with private institutions, including the banks, to make sure that we not only provide subsidized housing, we can also do a different types of housing, rental housing, bonded housing, and also be able to pull in some social and economic amenities as well, and business centers and areas and so forth. And from 1998, the department also established the Housing Development Agency that assists provinces and municipalities to identify well-located land for housing development, having an impact of decreasing travel times and reducing carbon emissions. The programs and initiatives that are in the pipeline currently, we are encouraging municipalities to develop their own densification strategies. We are not able to develop a national densification strategy because these have to talk to a particular area depending on the number of inhabitants that a city has, the land that they would have available, the other strategies and densities per square meters that they would have to determine based on the number of people that they have in their centers. Also, what we have currently as a department, we have advertised for assistance from contractors and consultants to assist us to align the housing program to the latest national building regulations on energy efficient measures, where we're required to have instances of ceilings in some of our housing, and also to have to design multi-story units to promote the densification that we try from municipalities. So we've advertised so that we can have some costing for these measures to cost how much ceilings would cost as an additional to the normal housing subsidy, how much the walk-up story units would cost to build the departments. Honorable Chair, that would be my input for this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Comments, questions?
Obviously, we'll have to embark on a process to look at adaptation in the sector, because I don't see it covered yet in any extent. But that is something that can happen in the next period. Ms. Wingham?
Thank you, Chair. The presenter, thank you very much for the presentation. The presenter was mentioning about the appointment of consultants to investigate the areas of efficient energy measures and so on. Have you been in touch with the CSIR, who have the prototypes of eco-friendly and houses that are warm in the winter and cool in the summer, and all the measures that could be implemented by the Department of Housing? Because, I mean, we don't have to have consultants if there's something readily available from the CSIR. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I will take your points, your comments on issues on adaptation. We are lacking in that regard, and we will be, from our policy perspective, be looking into those. And also, in terms of the consultants, we have been working with the CSIR. We wanted input into breakdown on the costs, to have bills of quantities, as it were, to find out how much one house would cost if we have that. But we can also refer back to them and have an agreement with them, which would be cheaper for us as well and easier, because they do have the prototypes. Thank you for the input.
That's it. All right. So we need to get, I'm told by experts that the area of housing and human settlements is an area where we can really move quite substantially on dealing with issues of climate change. Now, I'm not sure that's true or not, but I do imagine there's a level of truth in it, because everyone lives somewhere, except the really unfortunate ones that live nowhere. And so to that extent, whatever one then generates in that house and how you generate it clearly will be able to impact. So it seems to me to be an area where something very substantial can be looked at. And so I really hope that some efforts made to
to look more clearly in the human settlements area at adaptation there, so that by the next time we get there, we've got to see some movement in this regard. But thank you very much, and we appreciate you participating. All right. Now it's an input that we're familiar with. So I imagine that a lot of the slides will be this one, you know. This one you know. Dr. Preston, welcome. Start whenever you're ready, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon to all the honourable members and all other people present. Many of the slides will be familiar, and I'm sure we'll get through in the 10 minutes that are required. I'm going to speak across the main programs within the work, within the environmental programs branch and how these relate to climate change and are impacted by climate change. So it's both mitigation and adaptation, although it's principally adaptation that will be shown. Starting with the Working on Fire program, it's the only slide I'm showing because you are all familiar with the program. I think you also are very well aware that with climate change we are expecting to get changes in the pattern of fires and certainly in the number of fires and the intensity of fires. So it's a major threat associated with climate change. And I think through the program we are going to be doing, firstly in terms of adaptation, the capacity to be in place to stop big fires small fires from becoming big fires, through the very good legislation that we have through the National Health and Forest Fire Act, we believe that will also help to ensure that people are doing the right thing in terms of the protection measures that are necessary to stop fires moving to where you don't want them, but equally the importance of using fire as part of how we manage land and ecosystem services. And there's quite considerable research and work that's been done in this regard now through the program. So in terms of working on firewood, it's expected to grow. It has been growing quite considerably over the years to reach an optimal level with all the employment benefits that will come from that, to try to be in a position to have the least impact that is possible from the wildfires that we know are going to occur. The Working for Wetlands program, or the problem of wetlands, and I've put some quotes in there, but really just for you to read at a later point. I think, again, you are all familiar with the fact that wetland degradation is already a problem and that climate change is going to exacerbate this. And once again, the program is looking at the interventions that it can make. I think it's best known for the interventions around the water quality, being so-called nature's kidneys, but equally important and I think well understood is that we are going to have different patterns of rainfall. We're going to have so-called episodical rainfall, so much more rain and harder rain in many parts of the country, and that is going to lead to catchment destabilization. There is a bigger one if you would like that one. The ones that I gave out, where are they?
No, it's okay.
The issue of flood attenuation is hugely important. I think you've seen the slide before, but a whole field that's washed away where wetland has been destroyed upriver with all the impacts on food production and food security and so on, but also importantly on water security, because all that silt lands up in this case in the Churchill Dam. the issue of food security in many of the wetland areas, particularly in poorer rural areas. We are having areas that are degrading principally because of poor land use management and poor wetland management that can be addressed through the interventions of the program, provided that they are sustained. And once again, as in many of the things, the role of Parliament is hugely important in making sure that we have the comprehensive legislation that can be enforced. The disease management also is something that we know is going to become worse with climate change, and it's so important once again that we do the interventions that we are doing in the program, and of course water quantity as well. So wetlands are a net benefit for water quantity aside from water quality, particularly slowing down the systems, and that's what one wants to do in hydrological systems, is get the water going as slowly as it should through those systems. The invasive alien species work, that is the work of the Working for Water program, is probably the biggest of all the interventions that we're doing and the most important in terms of the threat of climate change. It's already a threat whether or not there was climate change. So these are species, as you know, that have come into our country and are able to take over from indigenous vegetation. We already have about 20% of the country, just under 20% of the country that is invaded, and that's not really counting all of the herbaceous species as well. So the situation is probably worse than is portrayed there. And these are, remember, only the plants. So we have animals and microbes that are also problems, and particularly microbes. So you've seen this before, that an area like this can double the surface area covered by invasive weeds within a period of 10 days in the growing season. The pines spreading up the mountainside, you've seen that sort of picture before as well. And this lethal cocktail of climate change, I have mentioned before, but to go through the kind of problems that we are facing, is that with the human perturbation, the increase in CO2 through human activity, we have the increase in the root and shoot size of the plants, and therefore the increase in the evapotranspiration that will take place. So we're going to have bigger plants, woody plants generally, not just invasives, and that's going to have a hydrological impact. But please remember too that there are many other species that currently are not invading or currently are not a bad invader. With climate change, it's going to change the pattern of where they invade. Some things that are invasive at the moment will probably become less invasive as well in this equation. And that makes management extremely difficult, because in our work, we're not interested in alien species that are not invasive. We don't want to waste time and money going and cutting down things that aren't a problem. So there's quite a lot of research that is necessary for us to understand species by species. And we've got 345 listed species at the moment. And then, as I'm implying, a whole lot of species that will become a problem, but we don't yet know the extent to which they will. And all of this will have enormous impacts, as is said at the top there, on biodiversity aspects, on the ecological functioning of systems, on food security, on soil erosion, on fire, and the health of estuaries, and therefore the health of our fisheries, and of course on water quality, water quantity. So it is already a major problem, and it will become a bigger problem because of climate change. It will also exacerbate climate change, particularly with the fires, that a lot more vegetation is going to burn a lot quicker than it should do if it was indigenous vegetation that was safe. You've seen these figures before. The estimate from the CSIR that the value of the work that has been done is, they put it, $400 billion. It's such a huge sum, I can't get my own head around it, but it's something that we are now going to have a workshop to interrogate the figures. But the implication of this is that is, even ballpark-wise, the impact that we have had, and we've we are still losing the battle with invasives, notwithstanding climate change not really having kicked in with the impact, then you can see the scale of the damage that is possible if we do not get on top of this. And I want to emphasize once again that we're talking about plants in those figures. When you add the animals, and particularly when you add the microbes, and particularly when you add the human health components, I think I've possibly shown this to you before, but this was just tracing in the USA. They looked at $1 bills and how they moved across America, and that was a period of 2 weeks. That's how they moved, and they move in people's pockets. And if dollar bills are moving like that, you can believe that microbes, your viruses, your bacteria, all sorts of other things are moving around at paces that nature has not evolved to be able to adapt to. Then just very briefly to end off, we do have our value-added industries. Of course, these things are effectively trapping carbon and it's something that will be rolled out, but the impact is small in the end in terms of climate change. The Working for Energy program has enormous potential. We are working with Eskom and the IDC, the potential to use the biomass for the generation of electricity feeding into the grid. The estimates are still in the order of about 2% of South Africa's current production of energy over a period of about 25 years. If we could realize that, the number of jobs that we would create would probably be about threefold that which we have through the Working for Water program at the moment, on top of, again, all the other benefits. There's also waste to energy, and linking up with the whole waste focus of the department, that's very important. And then also the focus on demand-side management and that's also for waste energy and water. And we have initiatives that we could talk about if the committee would so like. We have the Working for Land program as well. This is going to be vital for climate change impacts, both adaptation and mitigation. So where you have that kind of eroded situation in Sekekuni in the top left-hand side, it is possible to restore these areas and create jobs at the same time and create sustainable livelihoods that can then occur from something, as you can see from that picture, that where nothing would currently happen at present. And that will also link very much to food security, so all the risks that are associated with that. And then the Working for Wildlife program, also of enormous interest. The top left-hand picture, the speckworm thing, which again you're familiar with, it's a species that is very good at trapping carbon and doesn't burn very easily. And we've got a big initiative there that the Minister will be launching quite soon. But it also has, in the long term, high carrying capacity and great opportunities for tourism, for hunting, and for food security from a managed carrying capacity on that land. In other areas, in the picture below of the rhino and the buffalo, the potential to look at land use practice and what is optimal land use practice in terms of ecosystem services that will at the same time address food security, black economic empowerment, and jobs, and in many instances support tourism and hunting once again, is enormous, and it's an area that we believe is going to grow significantly. Again, climate change will come into this picture because there are many diseases that are either not particularly prevalent yet in our country or haven't yet reached our country that will become invasive diseases and will impact on the viability of many of the land use practices that we have. We've seen it with cattle in many areas. It's going to get worse. And then I just wanted to finish off. As you all know, our major focus for us is around the social development opportunities that our programs present. And we would argue that unless we deal with poverty and unemployment, all of the issues that are associated with climate change, all of the negative issues, are going to become worse of their own accord because of the problems that so many of our people have in the quality of life that they're leading. So there's that added benefit, I think, that we have through addressing the dire situation of the lives of many of our people. Thank you, Che.
Thank you. Now, I mean, this is obviously interesting, but what it doesn't indicate is the link to all our agitation programs and strategies. I mean, for example, I don't know, Ms. Beaumont, whether we have an agitation plan yet, or we're busy drafting one, or what are we doing? I mean, this is an iteration of all the things they do. And I can assume some of these things, I can think for myself, well, this way it may help with adaptation and so on. But the problem is the input's not making the links to me. I mean, some departments at least tried that. So I think that's maybe you didn't understand the brief very clearly. But I think that's a really worry to me, that in our own department we don't seem to be getting clearly what we're trying to do. I mean, the inputs here are all about adaptation strategies that we are looking towards the future and creating. But nothing is said of that yet. Any comments, any inputs? Okay.
Honourable Chair, if I may just respond. I think if we go back to the idea of the flagship programs and certainly the expanded public works programs and the working for programs are very specifically mentioned as one of the flagship programs. And recognizing that the flagship programs are about consolidating the work that we are already doing that contributes to our adaptation effort. And if we consider that water has a particular vulnerability or in certain areas there is a particular vulnerability in respect of our water resources going into the future as we are impacted increasingly by climate change, then I think the link is obvious that if we are talking about a working for water program that is contributing really positively to water conservation, or at least through removal of alien invasives contributing to water productivity, then certainly we would see that as one of the programs that is a contributor to our adaptation effort. And I think likewise for the Working for Land program or the Land Care program.
That's obvious. That's obvious. I mean, I can say I can draw the linkages that I sit here, but then I don't need Dr. Pearson to come here to tell me those things. I mean, whether you call it adaptation, whether you call it a flagship program, which is 8.1, or whether you call it mitigation, as he has indicated, that's all fine. But the problem is the input comes and tells us what we already know. This is all, and we support it very strongly, this committee, the work that gets done. But what is not here is, okay, so if it's a flag, what is going to happen with it? I mean, are we going to increase it? Are we going to do things? I mean, yeah. I mean, that's not here. So that's my problem. So I'm saying it's because there's no link to this, what we're trying to do here. So, I mean, if this is the correct input, and I'm not blaming you for it, I mean, this as well be my fault because you may not have been informed correctly, but if this, now, in 6 months' time, will we receive the same input? No. We won't, because it's a flagship program. So what does it mean to be a flagship program? It means that Vietnam has become part of our arsenal of tools to fight climate change. Now, in its own right, it is. But if it's a good one, and it's worth spending money, and it's number one flagship program in the book, what does that mean? Does it mean nothing? Does it just mean that Dr. Preston is going to go on the way he has and just try to do things better than he has, get a bit more money to get more people and so on? Or does it mean something else, that we're going to use it to do certain things, to do better things around the climate? He says, that's what's missing. So all the things he's saying are wonderful. I mean, I can't fault anything. But my problem is, as I sit here, as a flood program or as an adaptation or as a mitigation, what is it we want to do with this stuff? I mean, and I think that's what's missing. It may very well be that, I mean, at least the other inputs that were given all tried to make a link back to adaptation or back to the flagship or back to mitigation or whatever, to try and show, well, we're here, this is where we're going. This is my thoughts as our department, as our unit. And so I think that's just the issue, really. So it's difficult to engage on because, I mean, it's there, it's good, no one complains about it, but so what? So what are we going to... Dr. P.
Thank you, and I'm sorry for not following what was expected. I think what we could do, and relatively quickly, would be to give you a zero-based budget approach to all of the initiatives that we are doing and what it would take currently, and then with our understanding, and it's, as I tried to imply, there's quite a lot of research that we need to do to really understand it, so we don't overestimate or indeed underestimate the challenges. So we have all of that. We have the understanding at the moment of what it would take to get on top of what we could do through wetland management, through fire management, through those systems.
Look, leave it like that. I mean, as I say, we already know your work. We didn't know some of the other departments, so we know where the value of it lies. What we have to do next time you come here in 6 months' time, we've already asked Ms. Beaumont to call all these departments or units together to look at, if we say you are part of adaptation in South Africa, what does it mean? You know? I mean, a lot of things that we're hearing, it's just each department is going to do what they've done, they're just going to try and do it with better and they're going to adapt. No, that's not what it is. What is a flagship program? So you must sit down and talk. When we say you're a flagship, I mean, agriculture wants a flagship program. So what is it they actually want when they want a flagship program? You are a flagship program, so what does it mean? So, you know, those things you guys now in the next 6 months have to go and flesh out. Flesh out and say, well, this is what it is. If we have a flagship program, as you say, then we must do research in these different areas, the fire, the water, the da-da-da-da. Which of these areas really are going to be able to help our society to adapt? So, the immediate one that strikes my head is wetlands. If we start operating better on wetlands, means the water flows better, you know, those kind of things, the blockages on there, the alien invasion to take that out, that will all help us get better water, less chance of floods, etc., etc. If we look at how much it will cost for us to do those kind of things, and this is the kind of outcome that we will have out of it. So, when we say flagship, we're saying flagship, and it's, if we measure it with human settlement flagship and with adaptation and others, this is one of the ones that we have to fund, we have to promote, we have to really push. Because, or, it is an adaptation, but it's not, if we weigh it up, it's not really going to make a big difference. Then we must make that assessment, that's fine. But you see, what I'm trying to say to you is that for me, as we sit in these hearings and sit here longer and longer, now I know this morning what you said. I imagine tomorrow's going to be different. Tomorrow's going to be different because mitigation is different. Mitigation has different outcomes. There are targets. There are things that you can aim for. You can say this one does it. Adaptation is very much more different. It's difficult to work out the outcomes. It's difficult to do that. So I accept all that type of stuff. I also accept that you don't have a structure in place that's working yet, so that the thinking hasn't. So that's really, and that's what I'm saying, not a criticism. I think you now have 6 months to go, and the things that we've raised here, to think about and to say, well, what do we do about it? So when you come back to Parliament and we say, these are the adaptation strategies we have in human settlements, in working for, etc. These are what they are, this is what they mean, this is what we want to encourage, these are the priorities that we want to push, and therefore we need more budgets for this and this. That's what we are all about, so that we can engage with things and say, these are better plans that we need to put on the table, we have to promote, we have to fight for money, we have to etc., etc., and support. So that's really the debate we have. Now, that's what I'm saying. I know you had a bit of that, but it's not... Clearly, when people input into the white paper, there must have been some discussion. But that ended at a place. Now we've got to the place, now we have to say, so how do we take that forward? How do we translate that? Most of the input here came and at least said, well, this is what we're going to try and do. Now that may be what we want, may not be what we want. Maybe holistically when you all look at it, this is what you guys want. So that's fine. I mean, let's leave it like that. I think it's important that we sit down and look at it. As I say, even now, flagships, when you think about a flagship, it's like something that we've all thought this is a priority, and we're going to give priority to it, and we're going to give more money to it, and we're going to promote it strongly. I mean, that's what my idea of a flagship is, like a presidential flagship program. It's, you know. So, is it that? Isn't it that? I mean, if I look at the flagship programs, I mean, renewable energy, this kind of stuff, it looks to me as if they are like important and we must give them some status and some content. That a flagship program means this. Else it's really just words. So, I think you've got the point. Look, I thought in any case it was useful, although I don't think much has come from it, but it's useful to see the level of thinking in the different departments, to see that clearly where the weaknesses are, and when you sit here you can really see where they are, and clearly adaptation, as I say, I imagine is going to be different from mitigation, because there's been more contestation and more debate around and so on. But I thought in any case it was useful. I think the issue around the local government kit we'll do tomorrow when we look at local government and provincial government. I think it's out of place now. It's not. One of the things I want to ask is, tomorrow we've got a really long day. The program goes till 5:30. Is there a possibility we can start at 9? At least, because tomorrow is the last day, so when you finish you can Amba North. Ma, you can Amba North tomorrow. You'd like it. Can we start at 9? 9? Okay. Just make sure that after they spoke and so on, I think Treasury is next. Make sure that they come a bit earlier, okay? When we finish we can move. Although we can always move one of the other departments in their place, it doesn't matter. But okay, try and just inform them that we're starting a bit earlier. All right, as I said, I thought it was still useful today. I thought we the whole idea of these sessions was for us to get a feel for what is happening, and I think we've really got a feel for what's happening in different areas. So we'll see each other tomorrow. Meeting adjourned, 9:00 here again. Thank you.